Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. In this week's edition of MERS Monday, Mark Grebner of Practical Political Consultants talks about the struggles Republicans will have winning the U.S. Senate race in Michigan in 2024. Perry Johnson, John Tuttle, and more. Representative Graham Filler talks about how productivity credits, second chance legislation, and criminal justice reform proposals on the table are a step too far. And the food stamp fraud ring Attorney General Dana Nessel flagged last week is only the tip of the iceberg, according to Haywood Talkove of LexisNexis. Learn how the theft of federal benefits to states like Michigan is fueling organized crime rings in Russia and other countries. Now, here's MERS News Editor Kyle Malin.
Thank you very much. Jeff Smith, who's filling in for Mark Bayshore for the next couple of weeks, appreciate you putting together the podcast for us. Well, we've got a great edition ahead of us. But first, we want to start with Mark Grebner from Practical Political Consultants. He's here with myself and the boss, John Roerink, and Samantha Schreiber, as we try and figure out who the U.S. Senate candidate for the Republicans are going to be. There's two out right now. Nikki Snyder, who is a Board of Education member, and Michael Hoover, who is a private businessman who is running for the first time. But neither one seems to have gotten really much mojo behind them. There was an internal poll that was done by a political action committee over in Sterling Heights, and that poll mentioned neither Nikki Snyder or Hoover. One of the names that has gotten some circulation, though, is this guy named John Tuttle, who is a Wall Street executive. And somebody who's done some research on Mr. Tuttle is Mark Grebner of Practical Political Consultants, who compiles data and is a data whiz. And when you took a look at Mr. Tuttle, what'd you find?
It looks like he's a person who has never really thought about politics much. I'm really a voterless database guy. And so everybody looks to me like data from a database. Okay, so what I really know about John Tuttle is not about meeting him or reading about him. It's about looking at the data. The data seems to show that he's a reasonably conscientious voter who isn't around much in the state. So he's missed some elections recently just because he wasn't in town and didn't get around to getting an absentee ballot. He's always been registered to vote in Michigan. He may have voted in some other state. I wouldn't know that. But he doesn't seem to show kind of a consistent obsession with politics. Like his life was not about politics 5 years ago. It was about whatever he was doing, probably running businesses. He comes from a Republican background. His folks are Republicans. He's a Republican. His wife is sort of a Democrat, which is another indication that maybe politics is not that important to him. His wife is, comes from a Democratic family. So, it doesn't give us a sharp picture of him, but it kind of is a picture of he's no more likely to run for Congress or for U.S. Senate than a million other people in the state. There are 1 million people with better voter records than that and who have shown more interest in Republican politics than he has shown.
How many times has he voted in a Republican presidential primary, as you can tell?
I believe the answer is twice.
Okay. And how?
Twice. That's going back to 2000.
And he's 41 years old.
Yes, you've done the arithmetic. Yes. If you're right about that, then so he would have been just eligible in 2000. And I think that he voted in 2000 and I don't have it in front of me now, but one other presidential primary. In the one that it was recorded, he voted in the Republican presidential primary. So there's some indication he's a Republican.
And would we know if he participated in the Republican or the Democratic primary for governor?
No. We would not know. But we do know that he apparently didn't vote in 2020 or 2022 in the general election, which tells us, however deep his Republican principles are, he doesn't really think that much about politics, because just your average, not very well-connected person got an absentee ballot, even if he was out of state, to vote in the 2020 election between Biden and Trump. He's Tuttle is somebody who didn't manage that. Like I said, there are a million people who show more indication of caring about politics than he does.
I don't know. Do you think one of the crickets chirping right now might jump into the race?
Well, anybody who runs on the Republican side has got to bring one of two things. Either they have to have a name that is already meaningful to people, or they've got to have money. If you don't have money and you don't have a name, you're just lying there like a doormat. You know, the race is going to be run over you. And so far, nobody who has a name is willing to put their name on the ballot. And nobody who's shown up here that I know of has said, oh, I have $5 or $10 million. I'm going to put in this and run advertising. So sooner or later, somebody with either a name or money is going to make the race.
Why the hesitancy among Republicans, do you think?
Well, the person with the money is going to think, do I really want to spend $5 million of my own money running against a pretty well-established Democrat in Alyssa Slotkin and doing this on behalf of a Republican Party that is so dysfunctional that they're not going to provide me any real support? I mean, it's just a practical matter. Somebody who has $5 million, unless they have a lot more, that $5 million, you can do a lot of things that are more fun than run for U.S. Senate in that circumstance.
Is there a Republican who has the same juggernaut status as Alyssa Slotkin does when it comes to fundraising?
Well, the two parties are very different as far as fundraising. On the Democratic side, things have changed dramatically over the last 10 or 20 years. And now small donor fundraising is common and is a major part of campaigns. We've moved away from the institutional players on the Democratic side. The unions are no longer as important as they were because they have less money. And at the same time, there's a lot more money available from people who donate $20 a month or whatever through Act Blue. On the Republican side, there are not that many small donors anymore. The Republican Party is actually shriveling in its lower base. And so for the Republicans, the financial base consists of very large donors who may funnel their money through various entities and not directly into the campaigns. So the question is really, does somebody have the big players behind them, you know, the national billionaires or the state billionaires who will put up the kind of money necessary to run a campaign? I suppose those people are edging around looking for somebody, and the obvious names have all turned them down or looked like they have problems that would make it infeasible. I mean, I'm thinking Peter Meyer, for example, who is a great name, but is probably not the candidate of the Republican Party in 2024.
And I mean, how much of a role does the current culture of the Michigan Republican Party play into all of this? Because I've heard, while you may come off as a more moderate, business-savvy Republican, you're going to stay out of this race because of the more Trump-dominated culture of the party in the state.
We can divide the question of party, the culture, into two different meanings, and they're really very different. One is that the heart of the Republican Party electorate, the voters, are pretty far right. And so you're going to have to pander to Trump-leaning, election-denying, conspiracy theory, Jewish space laser concerned, transsexuals in the bathroom crowd. Okay, so whoever is the Republican nominee better not come off as a moderate, because that's just a bad word. But a completely different meaning of culture is somebody who can cope with the Republican Party organization. In order to run a successful campaign in the general election, you really need to have a political party that's behind you and is raising money and organizing volunteers and holding events and generally holding its own ground. And what you have instead is crazy people. And, you know, the Christine Karamos have got to be appalling to anybody who is thinking about running as a Republican, because you're not going to be able to turn to the state Republican Party for any help. I mean, it's sort of like you're running for office and they're conducting a fist fight next door. Maybe a better metaphor would be you'd like to have an army join you, and what you have is a drunken brawl among soldiers in a brothel. They're not going to be an assistance. They're going to be a distraction, and if anything, they're going to cost you. You're going to have to carry them if you're the Republican nominee for Senate. The Republican Party may get back on its feet in a few years, but certainly in 2024, there is no indication that there is a path for the Republican Party to be a coherent, useful part of a campaign.
Is that just Michigan, or do you see that nationally as well as we look at a presidential race?
It's more Michigan. Michigan certainly has it in spades, because this is the place that it happens that the Trump-friendly crazies took over the party organization. It shows, I mean, the same symptoms appear elsewhere, but I don't know that any other state has really got it so perfectly distilled to an essence where the state party moves out of its headquarters because the liberals are supporting and own the headquarters. I'm talking about Betsy DeVos and that crowd have been rejected by the state Republican Party as being Dem adjacent rhinos. Isn't that what Caramo called Betsy DeVos? At the point that they can't pay the utilities on their own headquarters and they spend most of their time denouncing conservative large financial contributors. I don't think that if you go to Missouri or Indiana or Mississippi that you're going to find that level of dysfunction. Michigan, I think really the Michigan Republican Party may be the most dysfunctional Republican Party in the country at this point.
If you're looking at the presidential race then, do you see an avenue for this no labels movement that Fred Upton is a part of? Do you see that as being a viable option as you look at an electorate that really doesn't want to see a Trump-Biden rematch?
You have to decide what you're talking about here. I think the no labels people have bet all of their chips here on fusion voting and getting a decision out of the Michigan State Supreme Court and permitted by the federal courts to permit cross endorsement of parties. If there is cross endorsement, that's one thing. If there is no cross endorsement, that's something completely different. We won't know which way the courts go until very late, but we really have to distinguish those two states.
Yes.
If there is no cross endorsement, then there is nothing. It's just useless babble. It is Ross Perot, but not as big. And especially on the Democratic side and Democratic leaning, after the experience of Ralph Nader in 2000, there is no sense, there is no humor, there is no flexibility about third-party candidates. If you talk about a third party in the presence of even Democratic independents, you get instant anger, fury. You might get punched in the face. Nobody is willing to put up with that. Nobody. It's the sort of thing Ralph Nader has taken to apologizing for it. And that's quite a sign of how much heat he has taken. Now, on the Republican side, of course, there are huge numbers of Republicans who have just walked away from their party and are looking for lots of excuses to vote for a third party because then they won't be voting for Trump if Trump is the nominee. That's a completely different situation. But if we have fusion voting, which I do not expect the courts to uphold, but is still an open question. In other words, if a candidate can be on the ballot and listed with two different parties, so that, say, Joe Biden would be the party of the Democrats and Joe Biden would be the party of the no labels people. I'm sorry, there's now a separate one called Common Sense.
Yeah.
Or anyway, if you're talking about something like that, I suppose, you know, there's lots of room for people to decide, oh, I didn't vote for the Democrat. I voted for the Common Sense candidate who is the Democrat. How that all plays out, I think that fusion voting would be a big benefit to the Democrats if Donald Trump is really the Republican nominee. But if fusion voting is not allowed, And again, it's an open legal question, but I think that the courts will not ultimately uphold it. That said, there won't be a requirement. It will not be imposed on Michigan against state law, and state law certainly will not be changed. If fusion voting is not allowed, then the whole thing just becomes sort of a useless exercise in people babbling about how everybody wants a third-party alternative. And then the voters stare into the distinct choice of Trump versus Biden, if that happens. And nobody is going to think, oh, I'll spend my vote on this other guy who's going to get 1.5% of the vote.
Why isn't Perry Johnson getting a lot of momentum in Iowa? I'm surprised that even Washington Post, they listed 10 candidates who are running for president. Perry Johnson wasn't one of those. And then I looked at the list of other possibilities and he wasn't on that. He is declared, Mark. He is a declared candidate for president. He's in Iowa all over the place, but nobody's paying him any attention.
I am Perry Johnson's biggest booster. I just think that I have a warm spot in my heart for somebody so futile and out of his element. And everybody who meets him apparently forgets his name and forgets that he's running. And everybody who receives his press releases loses them. It's not just that he's declared. Hasn't he spent a lot of money? Didn't he buy a bunch of advertising?
He ran a Super Bowl ad. He's finished third place in that straw poll at CPAC.
Yes, exactly. So, and I think that hasn't he gone and done obeisance to Trump? Isn't he one of the people that went to Trump World Headquarters at some point?
Yeah, when he ran for governor. Thinking,
so he's done, and how much money did he blow in the governor's race before his petitions were disqualified?
I think it was $7 million.
Okay, so certainly he's a big name, and he doesn't even make the list of also-rans. I mean, he's not even an also-ran. He's not like Marianne Williams. He's not like RFK Jr. He's just absolutely not on the list at all. And the answer must be that he is just so forgettable and so dislikable and so non-credible that he can't even get his name into the last paragraph of the story that is written to be cut and is only there to make sure the story fills the entire news hole. That last paragraph of dispensable stuff that you reporters include, he didn't make that list. But I want him to run for U.S. Senate because his money might buy him the nomination here. And he would be such a terrible candidate that I think that every Democrat who knows anything about it, which is nobody, but all of us ought to really hope that some consultant talks him into running and says, you need to start at the bottom, Perry. First, you need to be United States Senator. Then you run for president.
But he's got so much money, though, Mark. I mean, it would seem like if you've got that kind of money, you could almost, you know, pay for votes.
He should study Sri Tanadar. He should. Sri has shown that with a lot of money and good luck, you can buy office. But Sri didn't run for president. I don't think Sri could have taken his $20 million and made it into a presidential campaign. I don't know how much money Johnson or Perry Johnson really has, but it's not probably a billion, is it?
Oh, he's got a ton of money. I think he's got more. He's got way more money than Sri Tanadar, that's for sure. But you know so basically what you're saying is that after the failed run for governor, he should have ran for state rep, served a term as state rep, and then run for Congress. And then maybe he can work his way up at that point. That's what you're saying.
I think that some Republican consultant, and I could name five who should be on this case right now, should tell him that his entry level is the United States Senate. No reason to start at the bottom. Start at the proper level which respects your talents and knowledge, which gives you credit. It's like people who go to college and they get an extra year from some private fly-by-night university, and they get credit for having, you know, run a clothing store for a year. So he should get credit for all the time that he was inventing and implementing quality. And that should take care of the state rep and congressional period. He can start directly at the U.S. Senate.
Well, we'll see what he does.
I'd be willing to serve as a consultant in that campaign.
Well, maybe you'll get a call. We'll see. Mark Grebner, Practical Political Consultants. I appreciate you being on the podcast.
I always enjoy listening to myself talk. Thank you.
Around 8,000 food stamp recipients in Michigan, California, and other states had their benefit cards numbers stolen as part of an interstate criminal ring that was broken up through a multi-jurisdictional investigation that the Attorney General was a part of. We covered that this past week. And in total, it was a $4 million food stamp fraud ring that the Attorney General helped break up. Join us now on the podcast to talk about this is Haywood Talcove of LexisNexis' Risk Solutions Government Group to talk about this. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Hey, thanks, Kyle. I really appreciate it. The first thing I want to do, Kyle, is I want to correct you. The $4 million was what was caught at the time. That fraud ring has been operating, according to our research, for over 18 months and has stolen in excess of $150 million from the food insecure.
$150 million, and that's nationwide?
No. That's the scheme between California and Michigan. I estimate the program spent approximately $157 billion in 2022. My estimate is $30 billion went to organized criminal groups, both domestic and transnational. The transnationals include the Romanians, the Nigerians, the Chinese, and the Russians.
All right. Well, let's back up here a little bit before we get into that. Tell us how your interest is in this and how you got into looking at these numbers.
Yeah. So I've been here at LexisNexis for 15 years, and I've always been interested in program integrity, been interested in fraud and how it happens. And it really started back in 2008 with Hurricane Katrina. And we saw a whole bunch of government aid go down into that New Orleans area. And we started seeing back then on the dark web, all these criminal groups talking about how to get your Visa card from FEMA and how to apply for a loan. And it shocked me. I mean, I couldn't believe that criminals would try to take advantage of people that were having a challenge, where there was a natural disaster, lives were lost, and I didn't understand. Conversely, I didn't understand how the government didn't have the same tools that the private sector has in place to ensure some level of program integrity. And that began the journey. We started seeing, for example, in the early 2000s, tax refunds being stolen. And I didn't understand how the states and the Internal Revenue Service were letting these criminals so easily use stolen personally identifiable information to steal someone's tax returns. And in fact, my dad, who had one job his entire life and was retired, someone filed a return for my father stating that he worked at a large retailer when he had been retired for 20 years. It took him a year and a half to get his refund. What really got this thing going, though, was the pandemic. And I remember this like it was yesterday. I was hearing that Congress was going to pass a huge stimulus bill, literally putting trillions of dollars into the hands of those in need. And I thought to myself, they better not do that the way they're talking about it, because if they're not going to use information, if they're not going to use analytics, criminals are going to come out of the woodwork. We saw a massive influx on the dark web of these groups talking about how to steal. In fact, that was during the Trump administration. I was able to speak to Larry Kudlow. At that point, he was a national economic advisor. And I explained to Mr. Kudlow that we were going to have the largest fraud in the history of our country if we didn't put some controls in place, particularly around identity and making sure that you are matching information. And I was told back then that you can't have speed and security. That went on to turn into a $1 trillion loss for our country. Back in Q4 of 2022, that's when I first started seeing the food stamp, the SNAP program, percolate up, where antiquated technologies, I mean, they are using a glorified hotel room key to move $157 billion in revenue. They spend less than 1/20 of 1% of their budget on program integrity. In fact, the USDA is the only federal agency that has a benefit program whose program integrity team can't arrest you. They have virtually no rules on the retailers. You don't need to be a U.S. citizen. We don't do background checks on you. And finally, they don't do front-end identity verification. So Kyle, picture this. We're seeing in Q4 an influx of activity on the dark web. We also start seeing a whole bunch of police reports being filed across the country, like 17,000, about benefits being stolen. USDA puts up on their webpage, hey, be careful, there's skimming going on, you know, and essentially make sure you take a look at the POS device to make sure it doesn't have a skimmer. State of Michigan follows suit and puts some warnings up. Essentially, what they've done is they've put all the responsibility on the victim and taken none of the responsibility themselves. You know, trying to figure out if there's a skimmer on a device, particularly with the technology that's currently available. I mean, unless you're a trained law enforcement person with a specialization in this, you're never going to be able to see it.
So basically, this is part of a larger problem, the food stamp issue that we're bringing up, these EBT cards. There's literally billions of dollars that is getting flushed down the toilet because people are being able, have figured out a workaround, this antiquated technology we have at the federal government level.
Right. Yes, and that's right. And we're not talking about individuals here. We are talking about organized criminal groups that want to harm our economy and want to harm our democracy. When you're dealing with the Russians, the Nigerians, the Romanians, and the Chinese, those are bad actors that are using that money for really nefarious purposes. We're not talking about the person that made a mistake and, you know, forgot that they made an extra $500. We're talking about gangs, we're talking organized, and we're talking scale.
How much of the issue is with the government's response is the sort of historic government ineptitude with technology, and how much of it is just they're not paying attention, they're not at the wheel?
Yeah, I don't think it's ineptitude, right? You know, my dad was a public servant. Mm-hmm. Stacey Dean, Secretary Vilsack, I think they come from the perspective of we need to protect or we need to help the food insecure. If you're hungry, we need to make sure you get that benefit. If you're unemployed, we need to make sure you get that benefit. What they don't understand is how pervasive these criminal groups have gotten into their programs, and they don't have the tools, they don't have the collection methodologies in place, they don't have the processes that the private sector has. So when you speak to the USDA, what they'll tell you is their fraud rate is 0.01%. Right. I think their fraud rate is over 20%.
20%?
I do.
So based on what? Now, tell me why there's a discrepancy there.
I think there's a lot of reasons for it. So first of all, 0.01% is statistically impossible. Best in class fraud rates, when you start looking at the big banks, the credit card companies, it's right around that 3% level. Second, when you start looking at the processes, like think about how we just started the conversation, Kyle, when you talked about a $4 million problem and I said, no, it's much bigger. They didn't know this problem was going on for 18 months. And before the Michigan, California example, there was another example out in California where a Romanian group was busted by the Secret Service that had stolen $68 million. Right. So like they don't have the necessary tools in place to even count it. In fact, the USDA, when you read through the requirements for the two free payments when Congress passed the omnibus budget in December, they knew there was a skimming problem. There was a fraud problem. So they said, if your benefit's been stolen, you get two free credits. Right. That really isn't the way to solve the problem. That is an acknowledgement of a problem, and it's just exasperating the issue. So you asked me, how do I know the number's so big? So in December, there were 17,000 police reports filed across the country for benefits being stolen. In April, there were 250,000 police reports filed.
So just do the math.
Right. And you know, I was the one, Lexis was the one that came up with the initial estimate of $250 billion on the unemployment insurance fraud, which, by the way, Michigan got hammered pretty hard on that as well. The fact of the matter is that when you have a program that is a federal-state partnership where you're using antiquated technologies, antiquated processes, and you have virtually zero or extremely limited program oversight, the criminals are going to run rampant in that program until you start putting the controls in place. The other thing that no one talks about is how much time federal law enforcement has to spend and put their lives at risk chasing down these criminal groups. These are bad actors, both domestic and transnational. The money here, we're not talking about $1 million. We're talking hundreds and hundreds of millions and in some cases billions of dollars. And you can't put law enforcement and their families in a position when technology solves most of this.
By putting safeguards in place so they can't do anything. Sam, what's on your mind here?
Well, what are some things that you have seen in terms of states developing their own state level solutions that basically gives their systems more protections in a way that the federal system does not have?
It's limited, Sam, right? And that's because the USDA mandates the rules for the programs, right? As part of that omnibus deal I was talking about, the states had to submit a plan to get the payments. Everything has to gets approved by the federal government. So no different than what happened with unemployment insurance, right? You have well-meaning, hardworking bureaucrats that want to make sure everyone gets fed. But in some cases, they're doing a better job feeding criminals with money than they are putting food into people's mouths when it comes to the SNAP program.
Is there anything you've noticed that's quite particular with the state of Michigan?
No. Michigan just happened to make the news last week because that case came up. But I mean, I am sure based upon what I know, there's going to be a whole bunch more cases coming up. And, you know, it's always the same scenario with the fraud that took place in Michigan. That model is, I'm going to get the cards from one state and then I'm going to use them in another state. So that's so easy to solve. If you live in Michigan and you live in Lansing, let's just make sure your card can only get used within a certain area. You know, think about when you go to the gas pump, sometimes if you're out of state, you might get a little note from MasterCard saying, hey, Sam, is this really you pumping gas? And you write back, yes. And the transaction goes through. All of these technologies are available today. Now, what I understand USDA is going to argue, but what happens if Sam, who lives in Lansing, goes to Detroit? Well, maybe there's a way for her to update that on her phone. There's got to be something where the donut is more valuable than the hole in the donut, right? You can't have people using the cards consistently out of state. And that's where, like, if the USDA would allow analytics on the retailers, most of the fraud, by the way, on the retailers, it isn't the big box stores. It's always the small retailers. That's where the cards are collected. Then the big box retailers, as you saw in Michigan, where you saw Walmart participated and Sam's participated, they go, they take the cards. And by the way, USDA does not limit how many cards you can have in your possession. And they buy pallet after pallet of Red Bull. They buy pallet after pallet of Monster. And then they sell it. You can't tell me that isn't easy to stop.
You mentioned a very small percentage of the program's resources that go to integrity. Is there a standard in the industry or a figure you would point to? Is it 4, 5, 6, 8%? What's a good dollar? Is there a standard?
No. I think, you know, all you have to do is look at the private sector, and it's about 5%. And, you know, that's about the right number, right? So that's big enough that you can stop the crime rings. It's small enough that it doesn't impact your earnings. The difference between, say, the public sector and the private sector, if something like this ever happened to Lexus, if we were going to lose $30 billion to fraud, well, first of all, we cease existence as a company. Secondly, I'd be fired. With the government, what they're going to do is they're going to just print more money, right? There's zero incentive. There is no incentive from the federal government on down to protect program integrity. In fact, there's a couple of bills in front of Congress right now where the states would get a percentage of the money saved. I think that's an outstanding idea.
How much money do you think would have to be invested in technology upgrades to get the fraud percentage down to that 5% you mentioned, and how much would be saved per that investment?
I came up with a couple of numbers, and I just want to go back to unemployment insurance, where we lost $250 billion, almost 35% of every dollar that was spent. And the number that I gave was it would cost $50 million to secure the entire country. The criminals were just using stolen personally identifiable information, entering it into websites and getting benefits. The USDA problem is even simpler and easier to resolve. It's about $20 million and would probably take 6 weeks. First thing you got to do is we need to say goodbye to the Magstrip cards, and we need to put chip enabled cards in. The second thing we need to do is we need to do some sort of identity verification. The identity verification can't be you just signed the form and promised you weren't cheating. We need to make sure you are who you say you are. You actually live where you say you live. And then the third thing that we need to do is some integrity around these retailers, particularly the smaller ones. There's a report that was done last year, 20% of the card trafficking occurs in the small retailers. 0.1% of the trafficking occurs in the big publicly traded companies, you know, the big box stores, Walmart, Sam's Club, BJ's, et cetera. So that's all you have to do. If you do that, you'll put enough friction in the system and the organized criminals will go away. If you continue to create a solution, which to me is victim shaming, you know, make sure you change your PIN all the time. Make sure you use a hard to guess password. You know, don't pick up a phone call or an email or a text message that purports to be from the USDA. That's insanity to put that pressure on the victim. Individuals that are hungry, individuals that need food. I mean, the one thing that the story didn't cover in Central Square was the individuals who legitimately had their card stolen that couldn't put groceries in their cart and couldn't eat. And they lived out in California where all this money was laundered through the state of Michigan.
Well, we appreciate you shining a spotlight on this. Haywood Talcove of LexisNexis's Risk Solution Government Group. Some astounding numbers that you shared with us, and we appreciate your time today in sharing them with our listeners. When the Republicans were in majority, Representative Graham Filler was the chair of the Judiciary Committee. Now that the Republicans are in the minority, he is the ranking member on the House Criminal Justice Committee. Thank you for joining us on the podcast today, sir.
Yes, sir. Always a pleasure.
Danielle James has the first question.
Yeah, I'm curious. You know, it seems like you've taken a very passionate stance on quite a bit of this justice reform, you know, and that makes sense with your placement on the committee. But why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and, you know, why you believe some of these changes are so important to make known?
So I assume you're talking about maybe some of the press conferences or some of the public statements I've made in the last month dealing with second chance legislation, dealing with productivity credits. I'm going to give a two-step answer. Number one, when I was at the Attorney General's office, a lot of what you do is you're a voice for victims and you're a voice for people who have been heinously injured or had a family member killed in some manner. And I really saw sort of the difficulty that these families and these individuals go through. I've held their hands. I've worked them through cases that take forever and ever and ever for them to get justice. So these people did not ask to be in the justice system. You know, it was thrust on them in some terrible manner. So I've always tried to be a really loud voice and work closely with victims. I guess the second thing I want to mention is, you know, I was one of the leaders on some real key reforms or improvements to our justice system, expungement, raise the age. I helped rewrite the Sex Offender Registry Act. Civil asset forfeiture, we completely wrote and essentially rewrote our civil asset forfeiture. But in all those policies, I felt like everyone was at the tables. Law enforcement, civil justice groups, prosecutors, the Attorney General's office. And I feel like maybe that's not what's happening right now. And so these bills that come up either for a hearing or an enrolled with great support from the Democrat side, I feel it's really important to step up and say, here's why this is maybe not a good policy or policy that has not considered the victim. And so that's the base of my either opposition or vocal nature.
Have things gone too far? I mean, maybe that's where I want to go with my question, because you were out front on some of these criminal justice reforms before, and it seemed like you were all about trying to give these folks who have had problems with the law before that second chance, that chance to be good. And it seems like this is where productivity credits are coming in, is if you're trying to do the right thing and you're going to get out of prison eventually anyway, shouldn't you encourage positive behavior? It seems like this would be right in your wheelhouse.
So I think one of the questions that we asked when we were working on expungement or civil forfeiture is, A, is this a good policy? Is this necessary in the state of Michigan? And B, does it harm the public safety? Does it go to war with victims in some manner? So let me tell you why it's a bad policy, the productivity credits. And I think I'm pretty aligned well with the Attorney General on this. Right now in the state of Michigan, we've taken our prison population from 52,000 down to 32,000. If you are in prison, you take credits, programming credits, and you take classes, and that's 90% of prisoners take these classes. And the third thing I want to mention is if you do not commit another crime or major misconducts in prison, you are released at your earliest release date. So we have a system that's clearly paroling individuals when it thinks they're rehabilitated. People are getting their programming, and we are giving victims times to heal thanks to truth in sentencing. So my argument would be, things are going right. The last thing we need to do is go to war with victims who are very supportive of the truth in sentencing. And when I sit there as an assistant prosecutor, as a victim's advocate, and say, hey, I know that individual, that your ex-spouse poured boiling water on you, or stalked you, or strangled you, they are going away for five years on a minimum to 8 to a maximum. You can plan your life around that minimum. You can move. You can change your name. You can go to counseling. And that assuredness is why truth in sentencing has been so positive. And going to war with it on productivity credits is not something I support, and something I don't think increases the public safety.
So just to clarify, your concern is that Dems' current policy cares more about getting people out of prison as fast as possible, as opposed to giving time for victims to heal.
I think that is one of my major concerns. I mean, just take a look at this second chance legislation, which, by the way, is just really bad, explosive legislation for blowing up the Michigan court system. Under that second look or second chance or whatever you call it, individuals who have served more than 10 years in prison, essentially no matter what, get a re-review of their case. And it's a presumption that they should be reviewed and their sentence lowered or be released. So yes, that one is directly focused on removing as many people as quickly as possible out of the prison system, I guess, no matter how dangerous they are or the heinous nature of their crime. And something I'd like to discuss, I mean, these feel like the kinds of bills that send the House Dems back into the minority. If you look at the juvenile life without parole case or legislation, where Ethan Crumbly would be open for review of his sentence 10 years after he committed the four murders down in Oxford, and where these really heinous cases that have shredded a community, this individual could be released ASAP under those bills. That's bad policy, but it's also bad politics too.
Is this exclusive to Michigan Democrats in the terms of this push, or is this going on in other states as well?
I think the public safety question is a really fascinating one. I mean, look at the U.S. House probably flipped from Dem majority to Republican majority because both California and New York had major questions about their public safety policies and kind of took it out on the Democrats who effectuated those policies. And so I would argue that this is a full national conversation. And people, even if they believe, which they usually do in second chance and rehabilitation, they also believe that public safety is really important. And I don't want to move to downtown San Francisco. I've got questions about moving to New York. That's not the emotion and the mentality you want to create out of your public, your justice system policies.
I don't know if there's any numbers on this, Representative, but what is your understanding on how many people who are in prison right now can legitimately be rehabilitated and returned to society as productive members of society? And what percentage are just genuinely bad people who we really don't want out of prison?
You know, that's going to be damn near impossible to know because I've actually done a number, 4 to 5 tours of the prisons, And I did the Ionia facility where an individual, after they jump a couple hurdles, gets a really advanced degree and gets hired while they're in prison when they're a year or 2 years away from being released. And the statistics have shown that they're exceptional workers and that they do really well. But they're a little bit outlier. You know, clearly there are individuals who the court has decided, because of the heinous nature of their crime, need to be away for a really, really long time. And that's typically first degree murder. Even CSC one, which is rape, that's maybe a 25 year sentence. And so those individuals, you know, they have programming. There is specific sex offender training programming in the prisons. And, you know, some argue actually to me that those people will never be rehabilitated because of the viciousness and of the victimizing of another individual sexually is just, you know, beyond the pale. But, you know, those people are going to go back into society.
But listen to this, though, Representative. We've had people like this East Lansing serial murderer that we had, Don Miller. Every time his parole comes up, people come out of the woodwork and say, there is no way on earth this guy should be paroled, should be let back in society, and he never has been. So you could argue that the same thing would happen even under second chance or under productivity credits, that the people who commit these real heinous murders or just real bad people like Ethan Crumley, that the pressure will be so great that there's no way these people are going to get let out.
Yeah, but my question is, why are we creating this re-victimization, and there's massive, massive burden on the courts to re-review the individuals who clearly we know are psychopaths and are dangerous? If you look at the legislation, it's wrote like this, and I find it really fascinating. And also, I would argue that I don't think people are reading the bills, because they seem pretty shocked sometimes when they're sitting in front of committee and find out that the bills need productivity credits. They need 3/4 vote on some of those bills. And there seemed to be a lot of surprise that that was like a real thing. I would just say read the bills. Anyway, here's what happens with second chance or second look. If you serve more than 10 years, then instantly the court looks at your case. There's no people who don't get their case looked at. And I mean, if I'm sitting in prison, of course I'm going to ask for a re-review. What else do I have going on? You know, a little shuffleboard that day? Like, of course I'm going to ask for a re-review. So I ask for it. If my crime is so serious, we're talking about CSC or murder, then the judge has a chance to say yes or no. But if it's not that, then that case needs to get reviewed under that legislation. And that is a remarkable process of revictimization, of calling the victims, of telling the victims, you know, I know the state of Michigan and that judge told you that that person got life for 40 years, but they could be out tomorrow. So you just really need to be aware. And that strikes me as a really bad policy, because when you go through the process of being sentenced for arson, strangulation, domestic violence, attempted murder, all those things are already considered. So it is a second look, but I would argue an unnecessary and a really anti-victim second look.
Kind of focusing back in on productivity credits, you know, it seems like from what I've understood of the bill that a lot of those really dangerous, you know, criminals, like people who've committed first degree murder or, you know, some kind of sexual assault would be exempted from that program. And it seems like proponents of the bill package say that, you know, it's important to incentivize individuals to better themselves as much as possible. What is your argument against that?
I think there is a clear incentive that if you go to prison and you do not commit any crimes while in prison, so you're not resentenced, and also you take all your classes, then the Michigan Parole Board is going to release you at your earliest release date. And the vast, vast majority of prisoners are being released. And the proof is in the pudding as we go from 52,000 down to 32,000. The Parole Board is saying that individual has done what we have asked them to do. We are going to release them on their ERD. The incentive is sitting right there. It's really clear. And that's why I think the Attorney General, who is the voice for victims, you know, like she said in her article, if I'm not speaking for victims, I don't know who will. And I thought that was really powerful, because I have been in that office and I have seen how that office can be a voice for victims.
I wanted to change subjects here a second. If you could create the perfect U.S. Senate candidate in a lab, what would you come up with?
Are we talking a Republican candidate?
You can be Republican if you think that's the perfect candidate, or it can be something else.
No, I think the Republican candidate would be a better candidate than the Democrat candidate.
Okay.
I would basically say someone who needs to speak a lot of truth and be very open that we have a border crisis, and be also open that you're open to smart government spending, and that you would like to move on from the from sort of the anger that really comes from the Trump era, I think that would be a really good GOP candidate to say, I'm going to be pro-business, but I'm also going to be methodical, and I don't hate the government. I think the government can be part of the solution, and I'm going to be very serious about our border, because I've seen non-serious answers from legislators and from the administration about the border crisis. That's a real, that's something where you could really dive in and say, the Republicans and Democrats could come together and solve this, work together with Mexico, work together with South America. But I have not, I've seen the opposite of sort of bipartisan rhetoric on that, and just to get things done rhetoric. That would be a good candidate. And also a candidate who would speak really openly about moving on from the Trump era of sort of anger politics, because I think that's damaged the GOP in Michigan.
Is there anybody out there who, if they announced they were running for U.S. Senate, you would be extremely excited?
Well, I'm going to have to think through that. You know, I've really worked well with John James in the past, and I'm sure he wants to be in Congress and seems to be a good candidate for that sort of swing seat. But I think he would be a good candidate just because he seems to be open to having all kinds of conversations. He communicates well, seems a little more modern than many candidates.
What issues do you think could be the Republican saving grace for the state house next year?
So I think there's one clear issue, which is a pro-business, a pro-growth issue or policies, because as we've seen, essentially what we've got is pro-union protectionism, and then that hasn't led to great results. You know, we're, what, 49th in population growth. Everyone's clear what's happening here, that people are not moving or attracted to Michigan. And instead of sort of diving in a bipartisan manner to saying, how do we fix that issue? We've just kind of said, well, we've got to take care of the unions right away because it's been a long time since we had Dem majority. And so I think just going into these swing seats and saying, hey, you know, do you want your state to come back? Do you want your child to graduate high school and say, I'm staying in Michigan because it's awesome? Or do you want them to give you that eye roll and then try to move to Austin, to Tennessee, and to Florida? And so I think that's our saving grace. I do think the public safety is going to be a major issue, especially if the Dems keep pushing some of these very anti-victim, anti-public safety issues, because you'll find when you talk to people at that just sort of door-to-door level, they want public safety. And they love their local cops, and they've moved to that area because they think it's a safe area. When you tell them some of these policies, if they became law, I think that would be really damaging. So my push for my caucus is let's stand strong, because we believe in public safety, and we know it's not just the right policy, but a political winner.
Are there other areas you see the Democrats overstepping their bounds to the point where it's going to endanger their very slim majority?
You're right on point on this. So I was up at the Detroit Regional Chamber on Mackinac, and you know, the business groups are all sort of holding their breath, because here they are, they get pummeled on prevailing wage and right to work, but they kind of felt like it was coming. And then there's all these trailer policies which seek to even further sort of damage businesses, full-on attack on independent contractors here in the state of Michigan. And you've got these business groups saying, you know, the one thing we want, you know, maybe quietly, we can't say it out loud right now, is just a balance in Lansing, just some back and forth when legislation moves, instead of if it looks like it's pro-labor or anti-small business, then it moves. That's something they really want. And so if the Democrats, if my friends on the other side of the aisle keep pushing these anti-business policies, I think you're just going to see a wave of those groups saying, well, there's one goal we have. Our goal is your goal, which is giving the House Republicans majority. And so we're keeping our eyes open. You know, we're paying attention to that. But I think that's something that can really swing elections right there, when the entire business community goes up in arms against the Democrat policies.
Representative Graham Filler, Republican, up from north of Lansing. What's the name of that township that you're living in now?
DuPlain Township.
DuPlain Township. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to all of our guests today, including Haywood Tallcove from LexisNexis, Representative Graham Filler, and also thanks to our first guest, Mark Grebner from Practical Political Consultants. Post-production of the MERS Monday podcast was done by Jeff Smith today, filling in for Mark Bayshore. Also, a special thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. For the boss, John Rurink, and Samantha Schreiber and Danielle James, I'm Kyle Malin. Until next week, take care.